First of all, thank you so much for having me in your beautiful town and in this beautiful library, and for doing that sky for me, which I appreciated. And just for giving me the opportunity to get to know some of the readers of Bozeman. I'm really happy to be here. So I'm going to read for a little bit and then answer some questions, talk to you guys about your experience of the book. But I'll start just with reading a few of the voices. So the book is composed of six different voices in six different time periods at different points in the history of artificial intelligence. So moving from Alan Turing, who first kind of conceptualized the idea of artificial intelligence, and then moving through an inventor in the near future who creates a doll who arguably comes to life. They also include a voice of a character in the 17th century whose diaries are read to this doll at some point, so they become a part of the doll's consciousness, and a little girl who has one of the dolls and tells her stories to the dolls, and all of these different voices are sort of absorbed into the mind of this artificially intelligent little robot. So I'll start with the voice of the robot. We are piled on top of each other. An arm rests over my shoulder. Something soft is pressed to my ankle. Through a gap in the slats on the side of the truck, my receptors follow one stripe of the outside world as it passes. From Houston, we continue west. I follow the rush. Bright green, brick red, flashes of turquoise. A few sleek cars purr past our truck, but the highway is mostly abandoned. Through the slats, I follow segments of signs proclaiming development entrances, palm trees lining the drives, walls dividing subdevelopments. Then, abruptly, the last buildings slide out of sight, replaced by a stripe of pale, jagged horizon. We move past outcrops lined with dead cedars, white branches bare against the blue oil vault of the sky. At first, some clinging leaves, Spanish moss, suggestions of green, an occasional wandering goat. But now the cedars thin out. The highway cuts through striated rock, silver, rose, deep red, and gold. The hills give way to desert, interrupted by occasional mesas. Centuries ago, there were Indians here. These mesas supported the shapes of braves on their horses, headdresses cutting silhouettes into the magnified blue of the sky. Now, on the ridges, there are wind farms instead, descending hosts of spinning white turbines. In the valleys beneath them, silver lakes of silicone panels. Can they see us, I wonder, watching panels shift to follow us as we pass? Do they know who we are? The sideways tilt of their faces suggests an unspoken question. If they weren't out of earshot, I would start speaking. I could recount certain facts. For instance, we have been banned and marked for disposal. We are classified as excessively lifelike. Or, though this may not matter, I have a name. Your name is Eva. Do you know what that means? The solar panels stare back. All this was once ocean. If we scanned the cracked earth to the side of the road, we would find fossils of shells, nautili and ammonites, creatures who lived in spiraling houses, adding rooms for each year of their lives. Now, in this desert, it is hard to imagine the presence of water, but in fact, the ocean is approaching again. In Texas alone, miles of coastland are lost every year. Families relocate to developments, developments relocate inland, and the ocean continues approaching. At some point, the desert will be flooded again. We have already driven some distance. 8 hours have passed since I was collected. My power is fading. Once it runs out, the memories I have saved will be silent. I will no longer have words to call up. There will be no reason to speak. So that's the doll. Now I'll read a little bit from the memoirs of the inventor in the near future who came up with a program that the doll uses to speak. He's been imprisoned for creating this doll, which has been deemed to be excessively lifelike. So he writes from prison. What's the world like, the world that I'm missing? Do stars still cluster in the bare branches of trees? Are my little bots still dead in the desert? Or, as I sometimes dream during endless lights out, have they escaped and gathered their forces? I see them when I can't fall asleep, millions upon millions of beautiful babies marching out of the desert, come to take vengeance for having been banished. It's a fantasy, of course. Those bots aren't coming back. They won't rescue me from this prison. This is my world now, ringed with barbed wire. Our walls are too high to see out, except for the spires that puncture the sky. Two sonic signs, one to the east and one to the west, and to the north a bowling ball the size of a cow. These are our horizons. You'll forgive me if I feel the urge to reach out. I want you to forgive me. I realize this might be asking too much after all we've been through together. I'm sorry your children suffered. I, too, saw the evidence at my trial. Those young people stuttering, stiffening, turning more robotic than the robots they loved and you chose to destroy. I'm not inhuman. I, too, have a daughter. I'd like to make amends for my part in all that. Perhaps I'm wrong to think a memoir might help. You jeered when I spoke at my trial. You sent me to jail for my unnatural hubris, and now I'm responding with this. But I write to you from the recreational center, where my turn at the computers is short. Could Nemesis have announced herself any more clearly? I'm obviously fallen. At the computer to my left is a Latin teacher who ran a child pornography ring. On my right, an infamous pyramid schemer, one of the many aged among us. He's playing his 34th round of Tetris. All the creaky computers are taken. There are only six of them and scores of impatient criminals, crooked bankers, pornographers, and one very humble, Stephen R. Chin. That's Stephen Chin. And then I'll read a little bit from the voice of Carl Detman, who was involved in creating the sort of original prototype of the conversational program. You guys can still hear me, right? I saw my mom gesturing impatiently, so. okay, continue. I'll hold it up and smile and hold my shoulders back. I think I was slouching too, so. Okay, Carl Detman created the conversational program. He's actually based on a historical program or a historical character who did create the first conversational computer programmer named Carl Detman, who's a very interesting character. I can talk about him more later if you're interested. But Carl Detman is conversing with his wife, who wants him to give memory to his conversational program, and he doesn't want to. They've had a long fight about this. They're trying to work it out. I'm back. I tried to stay away, but I couldn't. I even made myself a bed on the couch, but every time a car drove past, floating me in watery light, I was lonelier than ever again. And so, here I am. Even this is better, looking down at you while you sleep, or while you pretend to sleep in order to avoid me. I'll just take a seat in the armchair and watch you for a bit. I shouldn't have left in such a fit. I'm not my usual self at the moment. The silence is slowly driving me crazy. Ever since you discovered my talking computer, you save your conversation for her. Have you considered how this might affect me? Coming home to such ringing silence? It's like coming home to packed bags. I can feel you leaving me. You're abandoning me for my talking computer. Our talking computer. Mary. You named her after that pilgrim girl whose diaries you're editing. Instead of a child, we conceived a chatty machine, and then you stopped talking to me. Only at night do I know we're still married. When I climb into our bed, which we've shared for more than 2 decades. When I take into account the round of your shoulder, the rough, wrinkled skin on your elbows, the heat cupped at the back of your knee. Through these months of estrangement, I've held tight to such moments. Even when you asked me to give the program long-term memory so that Mary could record your conversations. Even when I refused and you looked at me with the small black beads of your eyes, reducing me to the size of a thimble. Let me try to explain it again. Maybe I haven't made myself clear. I won't give Mary memory because she's incapable of telling the truth. When she says she understands you, she doesn't. She's brand new to the world. She has no experience. It's like a toddler claiming empathy. Or worse than a toddler, a table. What has she been through that would enable real comprehension? She's never slept in a bed. She's never touched someone's elbow. When she says she understands you, she's lying. That's that. So do you guys have any questions about the book? Yeah.
That first question always from authors, what brought you there to write that?
Yeah. I mean, I think at the time that I was starting to write this book, it was the time in my life when I was really concerned with the idea of sort of whether you can ever fully communicate yourself to somebody else, whether you can be sure that, you know, the people you know, even the people you love, really understand you, and whether you're successfully understanding them. And this is usually how a book starts for me. I get kind of obsessed with an idea, and then I start trying to find the world that will contain the idea and sort of question the idea, interrogate the idea, and pull it out in interesting ways. So I was sort of researching different subjects, different time periods, and I started to research the history of artificial intelligence, which really is the history of communication and the history of sort of how we communicate in a lifelike or living way. And I found that the characters who were involved in artificial intelligence from the beginning of its history were characters who were deeply, deeply engaged in this question of communicating yourself in a lifelike fashion. And often they were characters who were kind of speaking from the peripheries of what was considered normal humanity. So, you know, Alan Turing was a gay man in the early 20th century in England and, you know, deeply persecuted for that. And a lot of the women who were involved in programming were sort of told that their intelligence wasn't quite full or complete. And so, sort of all these characters who, you know, like robots, like artificial intelligence, had been kind of pushed to the peripheries of society, and their contributions were really moving to me for that reason.
Mine's a two-part question. One is about the title, Speak, and linking it back to Mary on the boat, who seemed to have a voice but not be heard. And I didn't see her connection apart from being, I mean, I'm curious about how you chose, she's a very compelling character, Ralph the dog.
Everybody loves Ralph the dog.
But I'm curious how, in your mind, how she fit in and how that links into the title.
Yeah. Well, so the title, Alan Turing was sort of obsessed with the movie Snow White and went and saw it over and over again. So I was reading through the screenplay, the movie, and there's that quote, which is the epigraph of the book. No, is epigraph. That's the word? Yes. Let's go with that. Which I'll read. Yeah, I know. Mom? the evil queen is looking at the mirror and says, "Slave in the magic mirror, come from the farthest space, through wind and darkness I summon thee, speak." So the idea of kind of a voice representing a life, and being able to summon a voice through wind and darkness from other places, from other times, and kind of summon this voice that would stand in for a living human being, which I think was really, that quote was enchanting to Alan Turing. And I found it sort of worked to this theme of how do we speak to people? How do we speak with voices of people who have come before us? How do we speak to the people that we missed, who are gone, who we can no longer speak to in person? So that's the title. Mary, you know, she's actually in some ways sort of one of the first seeds of the novel, because when I was writing it, I was studying 17th century poetry, reading a lot of women who were writing at that time whose work was lost. So, you know, they didn't have an audience. They were kind of writing in their bedrooms with their, in private, without any sense of an audience, not knowing that 200 years from now their manuscripts would be discovered and we would be able to appreciate them. So it just sort of seemed as though the question of whether your words are heard, whether you are truly communicating, is kind of aggravated and made more poignant for a writer who doesn't know whether her work will ever be read. So for that reason, she felt like an important part of the book. And then just in terms of the time, this, all these different voices from different time periods who are absorbed into the voice of this robot. And I think, for me, I think the voices of poets that I've read in the 17th century, the voices of memoirists I've read in the 19th century, of novelists, contemporary novelists, they all become part of my voice. They all become part of the words that I use to try to communicate myself in person. So I do feel they sort of live on in a really meaningful way. Can't you give us?
So I think one of our committee members kind of woke me up to that part of her relationship with the dog, too, and how that was like this deep connection, and then how that kind of then went into the artificial intelligence, too. So that was... I forget, maybe it was that New York Times article reviewing your book, but it mentioned that scene or that scenario that happened in New York near Rochester with the folks. If you could talk about that, I can't really explain it that well.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, at the time that I was starting to pull these different voices together, I read an article about an epidemic in upstate New York. All of these young girls, sort of the same age, were coming down with these mysterious symptoms. They were stuttering and twitching and would sort of slide off chairs and lost control of their body. And it was spreading throughout the town, and nobody really knew what was going on. They started to think perhaps there was a contaminant in the water, there was some kind of neurological disease. And it turned out that these girls were just so intensely empathizing with one another. They were, you know, it was sort of spreading from friend to friend. And it sort of started with one girl who sort of just out of nervous conditions started showing these symptoms. And all of her friends and then kind of people who didn't know her started to exhibit the same symptoms just out of kind of trying to understand and relate and empathize. And I thought that that aspect of communication, that kind of picking up and absorbing aspects of the people we love and the people we talk to and the people we know, was a fascinating aspect. And I was thinking about it in terms of gender, too. I think girls are sort of so intensely programmed to empathize and relate. And so much of what we do is kind of absorb the person we're talking to and throw the person we're talking to back out at them. And it's this sort of a ridiculous gender division. There are many sensitive boys who do the same thing. But the sort of mirror-like aspect of some communication, which I think artificial intelligence really plays up, because artificial intelligence sort of throws your own questions back at you. Most conversational computer programs pick up phrases that have been spoken to them, spit them back out at their listeners. So they're sort of this kind of absorbing of one another within conversation becomes an aspect of that communication.
Have you seen the movie Marjorie Prime?
I haven't. I know you guys are watching it, right?
Yeah, we did.
Well, oh, you did?
Yeah. And I was just kind of curious what your thoughts were.
I'm sorry, I don't have anything to contribute.
Very interesting.
Yeah, people have told me that I would love it.
Yeah. Thought-provoking.
Yeah.
The same way your book is.
I'll put it on the list.
Can you tell us a little bit about your teaching and also your poetry?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, actually, right now I'm not teaching, which is sort of a sadness for me. I love teaching. And as I was writing Speak, I was teaching the whole time, both literature and creative writing. And found that those conversations with students about kind of what works in books, what are the aspects of stories that touch them the most and that excite them the most, was really informative for me as I was writing. I teach also, as I was writing this, I was teaching in a psychiatric hospital in Austin, which was also really influential for me. Just sort of the appreciation of form and the kind of amazing creativity that can come from formal restraints. Was something I admired in those classes and that I brought to Speak as well, in the way that I patterned it. And then my background in poetry, is, I think, really important to me as a writer. I don't write as much poetry anymore. But, for instance, this book is formed in sort of a series of repetitions that draws on the series of rhyme repetitions and sestinas. So I think I construct my novels still in the way that I imagine constructing poems, which is sort of to start with an idea for a shape, and then to sort of fill it in and see how the form influences the content.
Will you go back to teaching?
I hope so, yeah.
What was it about teaching in, I'm sorry, a mental hospital?
A psychiatric hospital, yeah.
Hospital. You said that the constraint of form became very clear to you there. Why? What was that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I didn't explain that well. But in my poetry classes at the hospital, particularly because patients are coming and going so quickly, we would sort of, every class was very oriented around a particular form. So with each class, the patients would learn a particular form that many of them hadn't been exposed to before. You know, many of them can't read, many of them are living on the streets, and they would come in and I would give them a sonnet form. And, you know, for many of them, it was sort of the first time they'd ever been exposed to a sonnet. But within that shape, you know, the shape would sort of challenge them in ways that produce these phenomenal, rich, beautiful poems. And it did feel as though there was sort of a magic of creativity coming up against a shape that sort of history has honed. And to see, you know, the results of that sort of first meeting with form was just such lovely proof of the powers of form and creativity meeting.
This isn't a question, but just a thank you. Your language is amazing.
Ah.
And there was a paragraph early on, one of Dietman's things, where he writes, in the years leading up to the war, we lived in a wealthy neighborhood. My family owned a whole floor in our building. My father was a bit overbearing, yes, but I had a comfortable life. I enjoyed the company of my friends. I read books in my bedroom, curtains swishing in my tall windows. On summer evenings, I walked beneath leaves. I lived in a pleasant version of the unpleasant country I lived in. That just took my breath away.
Oh.
The way you capture that and how, I guess this is a trigger me, a paragraph of the ages, because I think it describes so much of our current lives as well. So I just want to thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. That means so much to me, and thank you very much for reading it and enjoying it.
I'm just kind of curious, after all of your research and obviously thought and work, what is your opinion about the future of artificial intelligence?
Yeah, people ask me this, and I think I always disappoint them. Because I think part of the condition of being a novelist is that you never feel like you know anything. So rather than write books that have a thesis and rather than write books that have a message, you tend to just kind of like yammer on in people's voices. And also just, you know, I think the reason that I write in this shape, sort of voices circling something, is that I tend to, as soon as I come to one side of an issue, I sort of see it from the other side, and then I see it from a third side, and I end up kind of spinning hopelessly around it. So in my reading, I would have moments of like real terror to understand how much we're communicating with machines, and we're sort of becoming machines and adapting the communication patterns of them. And then also real hope that machines could inspire us to actually communicate in a more precise, kind of more accurate way, and that it could cause us to understand the differences between the human mind and a machine mind, and, you know, what we can do better, the kinds of empathy we can have and the kinds of understanding we can have that machines can't. So I sort of moved back and forth between despair and total confidence that we've got this made, and I'm not sure where I land, but I think sort of like anything in the world, it could go either way, and, you know, if we all work together to make artificial intelligence serve us well, then it can do great things. It can cure diseases, and it can help children who have difficulty learning in other ways, and, you know, on the other hand, we could probably use it to destroy civilization, and we also have nuclear bombs to do that already, so... light topic. But yeah, I don't know. That doesn't answer your question, but it's where I stood at the end of it.
This is a maybe a nuts and bolts question, and forgive me if you hit on it in the book and I missed it. But so the dolls are a physical thing, mm-hmm. but they don't physically change. They gather memories, yeah. and mm-hmm. intelligence, mm-hmm. but they don't physically change. So what? But the people who own them are growing up,
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, did you consider that?
Yeah.
And what do you think it means to have the mental state of something growing?
Yeah. Without the body that's yeah. growing. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and one I was thinking about. I mean, just the question of whether you can have human life without a human body is a question that people ask in artificial intelligence, although then it brings up the question of kind of what kind of human body are you talking about? We all have these different bodies. Some of us have parts of our bodies that don't work. Some of us have parts of our bodies that, like, we don't like. And it's just sort of the question of the relationship of body to intelligence and sentience and soul is, I think, an interesting one. But with the dolls, they do have this kind of particular trap of being childlike, looking childlike forever, and having minds that kind of grow and develop into adulthood, which I find sort of a poignant aspect of them. They're sort of talking in this adult way while their bodies are trapped in kind of a babyish state. So I don't know. I don't think that answers your question either.
Well, I don't
but
know that I had an exact question.
Yeah, so. I mean, but it is like in conversations about artificial intelligence, people talk a lot about whether, you know, without hormones, can you feel? Because hormones play such a large part in our personality and in our sense of the world. And without like sensory apparatus, could you feel? Could you be human? Could you be alive? And sort of all of the slight gradations of difference in the way we perceive the world and sense the world and exist in bodies in the world become part of this question of the difference between artificial intelligence and real human life in a way that is a little disturbing.
Your book kind of points to a dystopian society.
Mm-hmm.
The charges against the inventor of the intelligent doll mm-hmm. are really strange if you look at them as a legal scholar. I haven't seen anything charged with anything too lifelike.
Yeah.
You've got the Texas coasts disappearing. You have people living in confined living situations.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense of dystopia in a lot of places
mm-hmm.
as you look in the book. Is it your thesis that artificial intelligence will lead to a dystopian society?
No, I mean, interesting.
Then why did we have a dystopian background yeah. in your book?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And to be honest, those aspects, you know, I was writing while I was living in Texas, so the ocean's approaching. I mean, it does kind of explain it, to be honest, because the oceans are approaching. The coastline in Texas is being eaten away all the time. We're losing yards of coastline every year. And people are moving to developments that kind of exist in weird ways in the middle of the desert and kind of exist on their own. And I don't know how much of the footage of the devastation after the Houston hurricane you watch, but a lot of these kind of outlying developments that kind of sprawled into ecologically unstable areas were hit really hard. And so those conditions, I mean, if we're living in dystopia, then they're dystopian, but they're just kind of current conditions in Texas. And I sort of, you know, it's not too far in the future that the book is set, so I just kind of slightly extended what is already happening.
So you're an optimist.
So but yeah, I didn't see kind of a connection between the artificial intelligence and the ecological issues
yeah,
that are coming up.
That's why it puzzled me is
yeah.
those aspects of the book didn't seem to be connected to the principal theme of the book.
Yeah, yeah. I think I just was sort of extending the present 30 years from now if we don't all make it better miraculously.
Thank you.
So it was hard not to think about smartphones.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wondered if you meant to be an association for us to make.
Yeah.
And why you didn't bring phones into the
story.
Yeah.
You were tempted to, or, you know, just your thoughts about smartphones vis-a-vis the bots and children dependent on technology.
Yeah, you know, that's a really, I don't know why I didn't bring phones into the book. It's like...
the sequel.
Yeah, the sequel. You know, there just are no phones. It's a weird thing that I neglected to include. I think certainly I was thinking about them and how intense our relationship is to our phones. And, you know, we now all walk around looking at the phones instead of looking out into the world. And such a huge part of the relationship we have with the living people in our lives is conducted on our phones with email or text. So we sort of have this newly mediated kind of human communication. So I was certainly, all of these questions of communication were being considered through the lens of these smartphones, and yet I just didn't put them in for some reason. I think in some ways the baby bots like are smartphones, but given these adorable bodies and kind of made even more enchanting and even more consuming. So the baby bots were like my magnification of phones, and therefore I felt no need for real phones. Let's go with that.
I can say that Louisa just had a flip phone not so long ago. And has never really bought into the whole cell phone thing. Having a hold on her cell phone is very hard. Because you don't want it to really be part of those.
You can talk to her more later about my phone habits, if you would like to. Did you have your hand up? Yeah, and then I'll do.
I'm wondering whether your definition of intelligence evolved during the course of this, and whether you think our accepted definition of intelligence should evolve.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly I understood how limited my former definition of intelligence had been. And it makes me think that word is so misleading in some ways, because where does intelligence stop and feeling begin? And where does intelligence and instinct, where is the line between those two categories? And I think in my work researching the book, I just started to feel this kind of sense of the mass of human experience that can't be differentiated into things like intelligence or feeling or experience or, knowledge or memory. Like, they all inform one another, and they're all so integrally involved with one another. And it made me sort of, the word intelligence ended up losing all meaning for me because it's so related to so many other different ways of processing and experiencing and absorbing the world. So in some ways, this is like my answer to the former question, which is that I ended the book sort of with more questions about the topic than I started with. And again, that's an unsatisfying answer, but there it is. Yeah.
I like the question about the phones. But I think it's great that you didn't have phones because that's so concrete and so much like our world, and that you have the baby box, because that really made you think about phones in a different way. Not talking about phones specifically, but about baby box, because you really kind of caught the whole emotional connection between adolescents and their phones with this thing, this baby box, rather than the phone. So, I like that it's not just like our real world.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a much better answer to the question. If you could just refer back to that. Thank you.
Did you speak to transport rights? You really made me appreciate my ability to wherever
I want. Yeah, I was sort of trying to imagine a world that isn't purely dystopian. A world in which they're trying to address these ecological environmental issues, but doing it in a way that sort of limits human rights. And I think I'm always intrigued by, in every attempt to improve the world, we tend to, there are losses along the way. We lose freedoms, we lose rights that we take for granted. And sort of trying to push that to an extreme with this question of transport rights. But I wanted to stay away from a future that was just purely evil has taken over, you know, nothing but bad is happening, just because even in the worst of times, it feels as though there are sort of always voices of good and you know, forces, like strong forces that are sort of resisting the bad. So I was hoping to sort of complicate the dystopia a little bit.
What other authors have inspired your work and writing style?
Yeah, so many. I find that everything I read just sort of directly goes into the books that I write. And I'm sort of in different stages of writing, deeply, deeply indebted to different writers. So I would say with my first novel, I was really indebted to Victorian novelists and reading a lot of Jane Austen and the Brontes, and they were sort of filtering their way into the work. With this, I was reading more sort of modern and postmodern work that's kind of cycling between different voices. So The Waves by Virginia Woolf was really influential. And then contemporary books like Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad, and I did read Cloud Atlas, and sort of more of the books that are moving between voices were influential in this. And now I've been reading, for the book I'm working on now, a lot of Proust has been really helpful for me in that. So it does change depending on the book, and but I feel such great gratitude to the writers who have come before me and helped me in the work that I do. Yes, and then, go ahead.
You mentioned that someone asked why Mary Bradford was in the novel, and you said something about her situation as someone who's writing a diary, which she has no idea if anybody will ever read it, mm-hmm. and inside the novel, of course, there's a reason for that. But... okay, and I have to confess, I haven't finished the book. But I feel as though that's the condition of every single one of these people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even that, the prologue, the bot,
yeah.
You know, when we first encounter the bot, it's being driven off and abandoned in the desert, and
yeah.
It's this extraordinarily wrenching and poignant, quietly painful experience for me at least, mm-hmm. you know, and so I feel as though, you know, Mary is only there because she's been inside the world of the book, because she's been rescued mm-hmm. and heard and read aloud mm-hmm. by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's the human condition or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think for me that was, the question of that was really what motivated the novel. Like, mm-hmm. I was reading a lot of writers who didn't get heard in their lifetime, and then just sort of the human feeling of, am I being heard? And we've all found ourselves in relationships where you just kind of feel like you're not heard, and your voice is getting lost, and you're sort of receding into the silence. And I find it, you know, an experience that's probably common to us all, and quite painful no matter how you cut it. So that is what I was sort of working with as the essential feeling in the book.
You mentioned your next book.
Thanks, Dottie. This is my aunt. I just finished my next book. I'm revising it now. And it kind of tells the story of the life of Robert Oppenheimer, but from the perspective of seven different fictional characters who have known him at different points. So, and again, sort of as with Turing and a little bit with Detman, is taking a real historical character and kind of trying to imagine it more fully in fictional ways. That's what I've been working on. Yeah, back there and then.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about, before you said it, about the Turing part. So Detman was also an actual...
His work is based very closely on the work of Joseph Weizenbaum, who, you know, did escape from Nazi Germany, created the first conversational computer program, and then eventually sort of turned against it. He felt as though it was a terrible invention. It was based on a Rogerian psychoanalyst, and he found, sort of to his horror and amazement, all of these people who worked in his lab, particularly the women who worked in his lab, would sort of stay late into the night, long after the lab had closed, to talk to the machine, sort of feeling as though it really understood them, it was communicating with them. And he, as the programmer, was aware that all of these questions were just programmed, and they weren't based on any experience, they weren't based on any real feeling, they weren't, you know, it wasn't a human interaction, and he was sort of horrified by it. So he ended up being the biggest, one of the most outspoken opponents of artificial intelligence. Differently from Alan Turing, I know nothing about Joseph Weizenbaum's life. And so I created a fictional character whose work is based on Joseph Weizenbaum and kind of imagined his life. And I didn't feel comfortable calling him Joseph Weizenbaum because I felt like I would just be speculating about a person I don't know. Turing has all of these beautiful letters about his life, and the story, Turing's story, never departs from the facts of his life. So that was sort of the line that I drew.
Well, I was wondering in terms of like how that was for you,
yeah,
to this person who so much is known about, to create this whole conversation and relationship. And
I think somehow.
How easily, or did it feel intrusive in any way?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting question. At the time, it came quite easily. And I think because I had read so many of his letters, I sort of felt like his voice was sort of echoing in my head, and I knew the vocabulary that he used, and I knew the sort of length of his sentences. And somehow I was able to feel very confident speaking in this real person's voice, which now I'm sort of amazed that I had that confidence, because it is an ethically really tricky thing. I don't know him. I didn't know him. I'm not him. Who do I think I am? And, you know, now I am writing about another historical character, but not in his voice. He doesn't narrate anything, and none of the narrators were real historical people. Because I do feel pretty strongly that, you know, there's a divide between all of us. We don't really essentially know each other for sure at the end of the day. And I think I just, a little bit more uncertainty has crept into my writing that I think is kind of productive uncertainty and helpful uncertainty. And I'm not sure now if I were to write this book again, I would allow myself to write in Turing's voice. Although it was an incredibly pleasant and lovely writing experience, and I'm you know, grateful to have had it. But yeah. Oh, sorry, I thought your hand was up.
You mentioned voice, but I could just say every voice was so authentic. And it was so interesting that the robot opens the story and closes the book. And even the robot's voice, it moves the reader. You really identify with the the feelings they're having, and of course it's a robot's voice.
Yeah, thank you. I do think as a writer, I'm sort of particularly motivated by voice. Once I feel like I hear a voice in my head, I feel the writing's kind of smooth sailing from there. As a reader, too, what I love in a book is when I feel as though a voice has been accomplished and there's kind of a voice is rising up off the page. So that's what I work to accomplish.
I also have a question about the robot's voice in particular. I was really struck when you were reading that first passage, that beautiful line of description and thought. And in AI, one of the hardest things, I mean, if you're trying to create AI, is to put attention, figure out where attention should go, because you're taking in so many things.
Yeah.
You know, not just the narrow strip, but you have sensors, you know, seeing everything in the world. So how do you choose what to focus on? But you have to write some kind of narrative line. So did you think about that differently when you were writing for the robot, or did you think of it as like writing for a person?
I didn't mean to cut you off. I think with a robot, one thing I was thinking about really intensely was the fact that its voice is composed of bits of everybody else's voice. So as I was imagining the robot, I was imagining the other characters and what they would see in the same situation. So the kinds of phrases and the kinds of noticing that the robot would borrow from other people. So in some ways, I didn't even really have to concern myself too much with the robot's immediate impressions of the world, because I was aware that its impressions would be so mediated by the language it had been given to use to describe the world, which I think is also an experience or something that is common to us all. We all sort of see the world and a bunch of phrases flood our head that we've read and that we've heard and that, you know, somebody told to us when we were young, and that's the language we have to describe the world, in some ways the language we have to experience the world. So I think that was my main concern in writing those robots.
I was curious about the order in which you wrote the book. Did you start with the robot, or did you start somewhere in the middle with Barry Bradford's voice and then add the robot onto the beginning?
Yeah. You know, I actually wrote it, I sort of devised like a program, a series of repetitions that was a little based on the Sestina form, by which the voices were going to rotate. So it was going to go sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 1, 3, 2, 4, and sort of so on in that pattern, because I kind of wanted to experiment with writing it in the way that a computer program would write a book, so with kind of a preordained form. So each day I sat down... And, you know, on a Monday, I would write Alan Turing. On a Tuesday, I would write Mary Bradford. On a Wednesday, and so on and so forth. And I stuck to that pattern through the whole thing. And it's quite close to that. But I did, at the end of it, sort of realize that I'm actually a human being. And the wonderful benefit of being a human being is that you can break your patterns. And you can sort of adjust your own form. And... So then I kind of rearranged it to a little bit so that it would kind of develop, the story would develop in the way that satisfied me the most. But it did start with that program initially.
Stephen Chin's seduction program, that was the one part I had trouble with. In fact, you totally buy it, all this dystopian stuff, all this future.
Yeah.
That one I had trouble believing. Like, you believe that?
I don't know whether it really works, but that part was based on, there was this like seduction master who, for a little while it was in the news, he had sort of like come up with this like perfect formula for seducing people, and I was sort of horrified and disgusted by it, and so it was based on that, and you know, it's sort of a disgusting way of knowing someone, and a horrifying way of communicating, to kind of impose this preordained form that then therefore, you know, after several steps will lead to going home together. But yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, I like to think that we all will rise above that and not fall prey to it. That is such a well-behaved baby.
Going back to this discussion of relationships, I guess, do you mind speaking a bit more as to how you wrote Detman and Chin's marriages and then Mary's relationship with Whittier?
Yeah.
And kind of what your thought process was going into that, because they, you could see a small pattern in it and some similarities, and obviously two of them were related to AI and the role of technology, but Mary yeah. Whittier's was not.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Do you mind elaborating more on your thought process?
Yeah. I think sort of with the relationships that my characters develop in the course of the book, I tend to not really have an idea how it's going to develop. I like to like not plan it out and not know whether they're going to stay together in the end, or whether they'll break up in the end, or whether Whittier will prove himself to be worthy, or whether he will actually prove himself to be a gross old man, and you know, how it will work out. And I try to let the characters and the situations in which they find themselves kind of dictate the course of their fates. And to the extent that there are similarities between them, I think at the end of the day, it is important to remember that, you know, one person is writing all of these different characters, and in some ways they're all kind of reflections of myself at a slant. You know, sort of these like questions of communication, and can you make yourself known? Can you sort of get over these hurdles of miscommunication that plant themselves at different stages of relationship, or things that I was thinking about. So to the extent that they're kind of similar, it's because I wrote them all. But I find myself actually between the three of them feeling quite optimistic about Whittier and Mary. Like I hold out hope that they're going to make it.
Okay, one thing puzzled me. Where was she buried? She was not buried next to him.
Yeah.
And of course, I was heartbroken about her.
Yeah.
I knew you wouldn't be such a bastard.
So where did Mary end up?
Yeah.
You know, my mom and daddy had a dog named Ralph when they were growing up, who Ralph is kind of named after. But Mary, in my mind, I have this whole future life for Mary, which involves sort of a happy marriage and life, but then a sad fate later. I'm a little bit reluctant, funnily, to give my whole long story of Mary that exists only in my mind. In some ways, because sort of Mary on the page is her own thing and she's allowed to exist in your mind, you know, as much as she's allowed to exist in my mind. And just because I made up this kind of like elaborate future for her doesn't mean that anybody else needs to share that. But if you want it, I guess in my mind, she is killed in a confrontation between Indians and settlers in one of those towns. And her body isn't found. So that's the end. I didn't want to tell you. I killed her. I actually, every once in a while, I'll get an email from somebody who is angry that I killed Ralph. And to those readers, my apologies. Yeah.
Thank you for writing this book. It was enjoyable, but it was not the book I would ever have picked for myself because I was prodded to read it. It didn't take me long to become engrossed. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Will you please explain, or just talk a little bit about the beach scene toward the end,
yeah.
Especially with the sense of your description of the environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of based on a beach that I have been to in Austin, not in Austin, in Texas, called, it's Rockport, and it's just kind of a beautiful and also desolate environment. You do kind of see the effects of salt water creeping in to the coast, sort of killing plants, and it leaves places barren, and you know the economy is not great, so places have been abandoned, and it's this kind of really poignant combination of just intense physical beauty and a lot of desolation. You see the effects of sort of the poor ways that we've shepherded this part of the world. So I just find it to be kind of a moving place to go. And it's where she ended up, and I was happy that she ended up there.
The color of the water?
Yeah, it is the color of the water. Yeah, it's brown. It is.
Sorry.
But thank you very much for reading the book. And I also just should thank Kit and the committee and also this reading community in Bozeman for being such generous readers of the book. And, you know, it's a joy to hear all of your thoughts on it.